Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, local family physician and your host for an hour of medical news, health and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails, and your live calls. You're on Ask Dr. Dawn. I hope you'll stay tuned, and I'm sure if you do, that you'll learn something. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We have some callers lined up on the line right now, and we'll be getting to them in just a moment. But I wanted to lead with just a quick story that I found very interesting, particularly in light of, again, a vast uncontrolled experiment on the American public that we've done in the last 35 years or so. It has to do with hysterectomies. For many, many years, the teaching in obstetrics and gynecology has been, if a woman needs a hysterectomy and she's over 50, you might as well take out the ovaries as well. You'll reduce her risk of getting ovarian cancer and therefore maybe give her a slight survival edge. Turns out, nope. Hundreds of thousands of women a year get hysterectomies, and it turns out that in a study of 300,000 women, about half of those who had hysterectomies with their ovaries left in, there was a distinct survival measure in keeping your ovaries. The women who had ovaries removed had a lower risk of breast cancer, 25% lower risk, and a 96% less risk of ovarian cancer, but they had a 12% higher risk of dying during the follow-up period, and most of the deaths were due to heart disease and cancer. They had a 17% greater risk overall of dying from cancer. They were at greater risk for lung cancer, go figure, and this is in the non-smokers too. So we don't know everything about why estrogen is having some protective factors. The Women's Health Initiative, which just dissed estrogen completely, inappropriately in my opinion, did show, come to think of it, there is this colon cancer benefit that seems to be accruing. Perhaps that accounts for some of the 17% greater risk of dying of cancer without ovaries. And of course, the heart disease risk, 17% higher, and that being the big killer of women with lung cancer. Well, maybe that has something to do with the cardioprotective effects of estrogen, which were also inappropriately belittled by the Women's Health Initiative, which regular listeners know I think was a crappy piece of work. And I think the people who designed the study went in with an agenda, and they met their agenda, and they got a lot of press releases out of it, and they put the management of women's health issues back about 20 years, and I hope they're enjoying their grants. Well, now I'm raring to go and raring to talk to you. Let's talk to Frank and Salinas. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For all the people who are older, like 75 to 80, who are taking like 80 milligrams of Lipitor or equivalent statins, you know, when you get to be that old, you've got tender muscles and you're not as strong as you used to be. Those symptoms, you know, are not more with age than with Lipitor.
Right. Hard to tell if that's from the statin or just from your age. Go ahead.
Yeah. So the two big dangers are liver damage and kidney damage, so I understand it.
Yes.
So, you know, liver damage would be sort of easy to figure because the people looking at you would say, well, you're turning yellow.
Well, actually, most people on statins should be getting monitored at least a couple of times a year with a liver enzyme test so that we catch it before they turn yellow.
Okay, so you could go on for quite a long time having a little bit of liver damage, and you'd be picking it up every 6 months if you were having a problem with liver.
Right, we monitor for it.
Okay, now the muscle, as I understand, the muscle damage could come on real quick. I do a lot of kidney damage.
I think what you're referring to is the myalgia. And what happens there is that people get an inflammation, a myositis. The technical term is rhabdomyolysis. And rhabdo is Latin or Greek for muscle. And it is a breakdown of muscle tissue. It's a weird and very rare side effect, but something happens in the muscle that causes the muscle cells to just die, and they dump all of their myoglobin into the bloodstream as the cells break open. And the myoglobin clogs up the kidneys, and that's where the kidney damage comes from. And it'll actually shut down your kidneys. It is, thankfully, an extremely rare side effect, but we don't have a good handle on who is going to get it. And people who get it definitely know something's up because their muscles do get very sore and their urine turns red. But it's a very, very scary thing. And like an avalanche, once it gets started, we don't really have a good way to turn it off. We stop the statin. The muscles continue to break down. You put the person on dialysis and you wait for the myoglobin to clear from the system. And then most of the time, the kidneys will come back. However, you're talking months in the hospital and a very, very serious life-threatening, but again, rare condition.
Like one in 50,000 or?
Way less than that.
It's almost something that you really would almost impossible to have. If you drank like, you know, 28 ounces of liquid every day.
This is the proverbial bolt of lightning. It's what we call idiosyncratic. So what we can tell you about it, it doesn't happen necessarily the first year or the second year you're on a statin. It can happen on year five. We have no idea if it's genetic. We have no idea if there's some other environmental interaction that kicks it in. It is out of the blue, like a bolt of lightning, rare, and it's part of the freight that you pay. You take that risk, you take that lottery ticket when you take a statin.
If you lower the statin dosage from 80 to 40, would that lessen the chances?
You know, it's so rare, it's hard to say for sure, but we think so. We think it is dose-related, but that's a think. And because it's so rare, it's very, very difficult to say for sure.
So if you look, check your urine, and it's not turning red, most likely you're okay.
Yeah, red urine would be big red flag, stop the statin, go to the doctor. And the other thing is to really ask, do you need to be on a statin? What are your other risks? Do you have coronary artery disease? Have you other risk factors, or are you treating a number? And the problem is, and I'm going to just jump on my soapbox for a moment and say, we need tort reform in this country so that I can stop being scared all the time about being my fault that somebody gets a heart attack or my fault that they get cancer because I'm their doctor. Because what we do with setting that attitude up in doctors, and that's because, you know, hey, somebody died, somebody has to be somebody's fault, must be the doctor's fault for not figuring it out, we'll sue the doctor. What it means is every time I don't put somebody on a statin, I'm taking a risk with my life.
Yeah.
And even if it's not reasonable to put the person on the statin, if the numbers justify it, I kind of have to take a big deep breath and gulp and say, all right, we promised to do this right, but I fear. I have a lovely little fear thing that goes through my head every time I don't put somebody on a statin whose numbers justify it. Because if they have a heart attack, it'll be me that gave them the heart attack legally.
Yeah.
We need to get rid of that head trip if we're ever going to have sensible drug prescribing in this country.
Yeah.
All right, I'm off the soapbox now.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. Thank you for the call. Go to Marcia in Capitola. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have a question also about statin drugs. I'm taking red yeast rice, and I want to know if it is indeed healthier and safer to take than a statin. And also, do you get the same benefit of reduced risk of Alzheimer's on the red yeast rice as you do from, they think you do from statin?
Okay. Qualified yes on both questions. Qualified because, you know what? There's no massive drug company supporting red rice yeast or red yeast rice. You hear it both ways. There's no massive funding supporting research because it can't be patented. Therefore, we have to piggyback off the statin research. But it's a pretty reasonable thing to do because the chemical in a red yeast rice is indistinguishable from Mevacor. It is a statin, okay? You know, it's biochemically a statin. The amount that you're getting in most formulations is about 5 milligrams as opposed to the 10 milligrams. Natural food people make the argument that because you're getting it as a whole substance with other compounds, that there might be some protective agents that lower the side effects, and that is a nice rebuttable presumption that nobody has bothered to rebut one way or another. So there's no research that shows it's safer. If you're on it, I think it's prudent to get your liver enzyme, your ALT, checked twice a year.
Okay.
Just why not? And
I think
it's prudent to take CoQ10.
Okay. It would save me money if I did the statin drug because insurance that would cover that, and I'm paying for the red yeast rice.
How much does it cost?
It's $50. It gets me, I think, 30 days.
Okay.
So instead of $10.
Right. So your $10 copay. There's no data that shows that you're buying anything with your extra $40. So, you know, if that's your economic situation, I think your smart move would be to go to the generic statin if you're going to do it anyway. Because while it sounds nice that there's other stuff in the red yeast rice that might be protective, There's nothing to prove that. Mm-hmm. And $40 is $360 a year.
Right.
That's, or no, $480 a year. Do your math, Don. That's some serious money.
Uh-huh.
I think you could buy additional health benefits. You could almost pay for a gym membership that would
right.
get you exercising and provide enormous cardiovascular protection with the money that you'd save on that differential cost.
And do you think that there really is a benefit in reduced risk of Alzheimer's with the statins? Do you think that's a reason to take it?
Might also be a reason to take an aspirin a day. The benefit appears to be an anti-inflammatory benefit.
Oh, okay.
And so you probably get the same benefit from high-dose fish oil, an aspirin a day, or the statins.
Uh-huh.
There's probably not an additive effect of using all three. There's no data to suggest that.
Okay.
Alzheimer's is an inflammatory disease. So when you reduce inflammation, you reduce the progression of Alzheimer's.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Maria Elena in Salinas. Hello, good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
I wonder how you can tell what vitamin supplement or any food supplement is better than another. For instance, does the stuff I get at Long's, is it as good as the stuff I get at Whole Foods or whatever?
Okay, well, there are a couple of things that you can do. First of all, the key issue is quality, right? We know when we go to the produce department, an apple is not an apple is not an apple, right? You've got some apples that are big and shiny and beautiful and very tasty, and you've got some apples that are dried and desiccated, and you've got some that are all bruised and rotting, and they're all apples. So if you put them in a package, your ingredient would be apple, and it wouldn't distinguish between the three. And as is very evident, what with the melamine in the dog food and the protamine sulfate, that one kind of slipped under the radar, but a whole bunch of people were poisoned from bad heparin from China about a year and a half ago, and it was a very serious problem. We got to worry about sourcing. You pay for that. You pay for people to actually open every bag of everything that they get from Israel and Italy and China and Taiwan and wherever that go into these formulations and run them through a mass spectrometer and make sure that there's no lead in there. And that costs money. That's time. That's energy. So your cheaper brands, like, for example, your Costco brands, have masses and masses of quantity coming through. And there's just no way they do anything but spot check.
Uh-huh.
All right. So you're paying less, but you're taking a bigger risk. Whereas the companies that sell on the basis of their purity and their quality, let's take Costco fish oil versus Nordic Naturals, which is a local company that I have no economic connection with, but I think is a very ethical company, and I've looked at their process. They check everything for mercury and lead. Every single pill has been checked effectively. I don't think that Kirkland can do that. And the reason I say that is they produce so much volume, I just don't think they can do it. And I have heard, I know the size of their testing lab, and the size of their testing lab simply can't manage to test every batch. And I don't think that they can sue me for saying that on the air, because I think they'd have to prove that they test every batch. And so I would challenge them on that. What does it mean as a consumer? Well, it means that you have to look at what you're taking and try to have some sense that it's been validated or tested by an independent laboratory. For $28 a year, you can join an outfit called Consumer Lab. They check stuff, they go to the store, they buy it, and they check for contamination. So they'll spot check for contamination and content. They can't really check for quality. They can't check for a good apple versus a bad apple, but at least they'll tell you it's an apple. And it really is an apple, as opposed to a pear, because they were out of apples that week when they were making that batch.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not easy to tell. And the price that you pay is not always an indicator, although I think it has some indication. What I do is first of all, I have checked out a couple of companies that I think across the board do great work and have very, very high standards, and I try to source from them. And those companies, by the way, are Pure Encapsulations and Metagenics. And that's not to say there aren't other excellent companies out there, but there's a limited number of hours in the day, and those are the two I've chosen because I can get everything I want to hand out to people, I can get from them.
Pure Encapsulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the name of the company. And okay. Metagenics.
Metagenics.
Right.
ICS.
Okay. Now, those two companies really do have good sourcing, and they are triple redundant. They get checked by other independent labs who, like the consumer lab, do nothing but get paid to check.
Uh-huh.
And the Australians have a government-sponsored outfit that goes around and checks for nutritionals, and their certification is a very good one. So if you've got the Australian certification, it's going to be advertised on the side of the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And so those companies that have that are, you know, reasonably legitimate. I've tried going to these agencies and trying to search the brands that they've certified, and I have not been able to navigate their websites. So I don't recommend that as a way into this. You can contact the company. They always have 800 numbers on the sides of their bottles.
Uh-huh.
And you can say, who does your independent certification, and can you send me your last independent certification report? One of the companies I work with, I believe it's Pure, ships that out to me every year on a CD. And it's just their latest validation of all their products.
Oh, huh. Okay.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Bye.
It's a jungle out there.
Yeah.
Oh, and let me just say, except in specific circumstances like CoQ10 for heart disease and things like that, if you're going after just antioxidants,
uh-huh.
if that's kind of your goal, try to eat the food. Try to eat
yeah.
antioxidant-rich foods, because
yeah.
anytime you go into an extract, you are losing value as far as synergy is concerned. We don't know how to construct the extracts to have synergy. The foods have literally millions of years of figuring out how to build a team, like a dream team of different compounds in the blueberry that all work together to make it a fabulous antioxidant.
Right.
And so when we just take out one of the arabinoflavonoids and say, oh, well, we've got blueberry extract here.
Yeah.
Whenever possible, go for the whole food.
Yeah, hubris. You know, we really don't know that much about it.
No.
Just doing the best we can.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I want to take a moment and take care of a few emails. This one from Jim in Maine, following up on a previous show about dry eyes. A lady called and talked about dry eye last week. Mine's so severe that it's hard to get a proper prescription for glasses. The drug she saw on TV was Restasis. By the way, Restasis is cyclosporin, an organ transplant rejection drug. It is not a hormone, as that caller mistakenly said. Jim in Maine says, I took part in the trials for it and it worked well, but my eye doctor told me to take 5,000 milligrams of flaxseed oil a day and see if it would help. So I tried that too, and it works just as well as the Restasis. So I wanted to share that with all of you dry eye people out there. I'm just transferring an opinion from Jim in Maine, but I will tell you my opinion is that 5,000 milligrams of flaxseed oil might give you the runs, but otherwise would be a very benign thing to do as long as you keep it in the refrigerator and don't let it go rancid. And if that substitutes for a $100 a month eye drop, let's go there, right? Because flaxseed oil has a lot of other advantages, including providing you with needed omega-3s. So, better choice. One more email, this one for James in Santa Cruz. Friend of mine just under 30 has been diagnosed with a serious form of skin cancer. I'm assuming this is melanoma. He's mentally resisting his doctor's advice to accept intrusive surgery. He's making statements about holistic medicine that sound alarming to me. I'm contacting you because you are the only MD I know who seems sympathetic to alternative medicine, broadly defined, while respecting scientific criteria. There are other doctors like me, Jacques, but thank you for the compliment. So, just on the subject, if this is a melanoma skin cancer, you want that puppy gone and you want it dug out with margins. And if you go beyond a certain depth, and these are called Clark's levels, if you have a Clark's level that says that this could have spread, then you do the chemo. And there is a wonderful therapy now where they actually make antibodies against your own melanoma cells. So this is tailored chemotherapy effectively. And it's immune therapy for melanoma. That's what you should be trying to get, because that will search out any melanoma cell that's escaped into your lymphatics or into your bloodstream and kill it. And that's what you want. This is nasty and it likes to go to your brain. I'm sorry, there's a lot of bad cancers, but cancer that eats your brain is the worst of all. So this is one where you don't want to be holistic and ignore the scientific part. You want to do the scientific and support your reaction to the chemo and the immune therapy with holistic treatments. I strongly recommend acupuncture and Chinese medicine for support when people are doing any kind of chemotherapy. It can have miraculously helpful reduction of side effects. The other thing that Jock wanted to mention was he wanted to hear about the nationalized health systems abroad. We'll be doing an interview soon looking at single payer. And during that time, I'd plan to talk about the French system as well, Jock. But just to say that the French system works very well for the people who are in there. It is government funded. The way the French do it is that they also fund education. And when I was living in France, lo, these many years in the late 1970s, I was very surprised because anybody who wanted to and who could pass a test could get into medical school. And the government wouldn't pay for your education. So as long as you kept your grades up, you could be a doctor. As a result, France has like 4 or 5 times more doctors to population than in any other country in Europe, and certainly way more than Canada or the United States. As a result, doctors are cheap. Doctors actually don't make that much money in France. They make perhaps a third. They make about as much as a high school teacher makes. And they are not busy. They might see 10 or 12 patients a day, be very thorough, spend a lot of time with them. The doctors that I talk to are very happy. Last time I was in France, the doctors are content. They didn't go into it to make money. They didn't go into it to be rich. And they weren't required to go deeply into debt to do it. And so guess what? The French have a system where medical care is widely available and doctor face time is not at the premium price it is here. And they also don't pay doctors tons of money to do procedures such that they get a lot of unnecessary procedures. Is this any way to run a healthcare system? You bet it is. Let's go to Jerry in Santa Cruz.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Dawn. I learned so much when I listened to your show. I was a little bit alarmed when you discussed earlier about the hysterectomy and having ovaries removed and the increased risk of cancer and heart disease. And I was wondering, because I did have a hysterectomy at 50 and my ovaries removed, would the replacement therapy decrease those risks?
Probably. In this study, they didn't break out estrogen replacement therapy that I know of. I haven't read the original study. I'm looking at a press release here. But basically, the researchers suggest that women who kept their ovaries lived longer because they had androstenedione and testosterone being created by the ovaries and converted to estrogen by fat and muscle. Therefore, and this is an extrapolation, okay, so we are making a logical leap here. This is not scientifically validated, and I want to qualify that. Logically, if you replace estrogen at small postmenopausal replacement doses, you should obviate those effects.
Okay, so something like the esteroidal patch.
Exactly. Exactly. And okay. I have to say, and I'm a maverick, surprise. Anybody surprised? I still recommend
hormone. That's what I like about you.
Yeah, I still recommend hormone replacement therapy in women who are not high risk for breast cancer. And I recommend they monitor their breasts because the other risks are greater. Dying of an osteoporosis, dying of heart disease. The data really does support that low-dose estrogen therapy is good for you when you play out all the numbers and you look at what's your risk of dying from this and what's your risk of dying for that and all-cause mortality. It wins. When you talk about breast cancer, it loses. Okay.
Because okay. I have heart disease as well, so that's why I'm even more concerned.
But if you already have heart disease and you are premenopausal and they take your ovaries, you should start hormone replacement right away. If you're postmenopausal and you've already gone through estrogen withdrawal, when you first start the estrogen, because their estrogen has a procoagulant effect. So let's take 60-year-old women, post-hysterectomy, ovaries gone, they've gone through their menopause, they're not on hormone replacement therapy. Some of them will have some heart disease. We put them on estrogen. The first 2 years, the event rates go up, so there's more heart attacks and more strokes because of the procoagulant effect. Then after 4 years, the event rates start to drop. That's the stroke and heart attack, and that's because the estrogen has prevented further disease from happening. But those people who already have a plaque that's just waiting to let go and start estrogen will have initially an increase in events. So it's tricky. You really have to individualize it. You know what? There's no one-size-fits-all advice here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, maybe I'll speak to my cardiologist and gynecologist and see what they think.
Yeah, take it in context.
Okay, thank you so much.
And tell them you won't sue them for taking their advice. No, tell them. Tell them you want to do this, and they don't object strenuously, you're going to do it, but you will hold them harmless, and then you might get the truth.
yeah, I would never consider doing that anyway, but thank you for your advice.
Yeah, but you still need to say it. Okay.
Okay, I will.
Good luck.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. And isn't that a hell of a note that you have to actually, like, coax the information out of your doctor, because the doctor's best move is to go with the standard plan, the boilerplate advice, because it's quote-unquote standard of care, and if you give standard of care advice, you don't have any liability. Whereas if you go outside of the standard of care and actually use your brain cells, all those well-trained brain cells, and individualize to the actual patient, well, then you're taking a risk. What a system. Let's go to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. Unfortunately, this is a secondhand call, and I think you might have already covered a little bit of this, so I'll be brief. I'm calling for a friend who's 55, postmenopausal, has been told that she's almost out of estrogen. Because of everything she's heard, wants to do supplements rather than replacement. I've been trying to write down everything you've been saying as quickly as I can. She asked me to ask you about books, and I've had a really tough time doing research for her myself. She's super busy.
Mm-hmm.
I keep hearing the book's really cool, and then I read these reviews that say this woman is catastrophically horrible.
Well, that would be T.S. Wiley.
Amanda Crawford, Christiane Northrup, or two others that mm-hmm. I've got.
Lots of controversy about those names
Susan
as well.
Susan Reed seems to have a more... Do you get the drift of my question. What about the complete lack of estrogen? Is it dangerous not to take supplements? And B, do you have... what books do you recommend?
Okay. The complete lack of estrogen means that you will have certain changes that occur in your body. And 10 years after you have no additional estrogen, your cardiovascular risk, all things being equal and that being the only change, is the same as a man of your age. So the people who don't use estrogen, their coronaries clog up.
Okay.
And a man your age. So there are plenty of men who don't get heart attacks, so you might be one of them. But the risk does go out to the same risk, so we know something's up there. Bones, it's pretty obvious. The earlier you go through menopause, the more osteoporosis. Osteoporosis kills more people every year than breast cancer. So when you look at mortality, that favors estrogen.
These are arguments for the supplement, you're saying.
These are arguments for supplements.
Yes.
I'll get to herbs in a minute.
Yeah.
Osteoporosis, heart disease. Now, breast cancer, if you get breast cancer, estrogen definitely makes it grow faster. If you process estrogen in a certain way, whether it comes from inside or outside your body, you have an increased risk of breast cancer. That varies from individual to individual. So within women, there's a cohort who I don't recommend estrogen replacement for, and I do put on herbs. If they're processing their estrogen in a way that doesn't put them at increased risk of breast cancer, I just counsel them to do annual monitoring and to understand that if they do get breast cancer, we have to find it early because it will grow faster while they're on estrogen. The third thing is the herbs. And many of the herbs are essentially plant estrogen. Dong Quai is a Chinese herb. That's plant estrogen. Black cohosh, red clover, these are traditional drugs used for menopause, and they are all weak binders to the estrogen receptor. What data we have shows that they work depending upon the shape of your receptor. So about 30% of people in double-blind studies respond to black cohosh, about 30% to soy isoflavones. If it fits into the estrogen receptor, does it also stimulate growth in breast cancers? The answer to that is maybe. Data's not clear, but probably. I think it'd be fair to assume it does. So I don't know that you protect yourself from breast cancers by taking herbs. If you're taking the herbs in a high enough dose to provide relief from, let's say, menopausal symptoms or to protect your bones.
And how do you monitor whether these things are working or not?
Well, it depends on what you're treating. If you're treating heart disease, you can monitor the lipids. And something called PAI1, which is a coagulation protein that estrogen influences. If you are looking at bones, you can monitor the pyridinium crosslinks. Those are breakdown products, and you can tell whether you're in negative bone balance or positive bone balance by looking at those in the urine. If we're talking about symptoms, well, symptoms are evident to the person who has them. So then you know
whether.
So that's how you monitor symptom control. I hope that's been helpful for you. There are so many things. If you go to the website and just pull down links on the website, you will find a lot of very good things in terms of authors.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
I want to just take a moment and answer an off-air question. Caller wanted to know, does microwaves destroy the value in foods such as vitamins? Yeah, it actually does. Microwaves destroy a lot of the nutritional value of food. And vitamins are very fragile molecules. The act of heating them with a microwave does reduce the amount by a process called racemization. It's the same thing that happens when you cook, if you cook at high temperature. So you could say that cooking destroys the value of vitamins as well, and you'd be right. The best way to get vitamins from food is to eat them raw if you have a good digestive system. If you're weak and old and you don't necessarily have a great digestive system, the next best thing to do is steamed vegetables or raw vegetables run through a blender and turned into mush, which releases the intrinsic enzymes in the plants and helps you digest the nutrients. I hope that's helpful. But yes, it's very, very definite scientific data that you lose the vitamin value of food when you microwave it. So our process of, you know, having everybody in the family pick their own microwave dinner and cook it and sit down and eat is, well, it's not our process. I hope it's not yours, but that's a widespread practice sociologically in the United States. And we're basically turning good food into empty calories by using microwaves. Microwaves are to be used cautiously and not regularly, in my opinion. Let's talk to Beulah in Carmel. Hello, Beulah, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. So I saw on BBC yesterday a new result for using ginger to help prevent the nausea from chemotherapy.
And I just happen to have that article right here. It caught my eye as
National Cancer Institute, 644 patients. The whole thing was that they gave the ginger 3 days before the chemotherapy. It seems to be making a huge difference.
Right.
I thought it would be good to put that out there. They say that the capsules, ginger capsules, sold in health food stores will probably work until these other things come out, you know, as quote medicine. But ginger cookies, ginger tea, and ginger ale do not do it.
Right. You need the actual raw or dried ginger.
Right.
And personally, I would just be chopping up ginger and putting it into capsules. The amounts that they were using were 1.5 grams.
Instead of a quarter to half a teaspoonful of ground ginger.
Right. And of course, if you have a scale, you can weigh out what a gram of chopped ginger is. But the basics is that you can fit it into a large capsule and swallow it.
Right.
And be getting about the dose they're talking about. Now, I wanted to point this out to people, and you picked it up. You caught the key data here. It had to be started 3 days before.
Right.
And it makes me think of something else called the scopolamine patch that we give to people for seasickness. And, of course, what is that but nausea and vomiting? One of the keys that you have to tell the patient when you prescribe the patch is this needs to be on 4 hours before whatever is going to make you nauseated happens. So if someone's, let's say, taking a cruise and they get seasick, they're supposed to put it on 4 hours before they get on the boat. Once they're on the boat, the scopolamine patch will not work. And I think that tells us, and this is a pharmaceutical, so this is a very powerful drug. Here we're using a food and a concentrated food, and it's not as powerful. But the lesson here is that lead time. You need time, whatever the mechanism of nausea and vomiting is from chemo, and we think it's mediated by the medulla oblongata, which essentially samples the blood as it goes by, and when it finds compounds that resemble plant poisons, alkaloids, in other words, it causes nausea and vomiting because this is an evolutionary holdover from the days when we were, well, not even hunter-gatherers, when we were simians, you know, wandering around, anthropoids. And it's like, oh, this looks like a potato. I think I'll eat it. And you ate some of it, and it contained datura, and it contains, you know, belladonna alkaloids or something. And your medulla would say, oh, this looks like a belladonna alkaloid. I'm going to make you throw this up. So that you don't die of poisoning.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a safety thing that we're causing to misfire when we give chemotherapy. So I thought it was a fascinating thing. And there are previous studies that showed, proved, that ginger didn't work. And the difference is here, they did what the old herbal books say, which is use it for several days before getting on the boat, so to speak. If you design a study, and there have been plenty of studies that show that, you know, this herb doesn't work, that herb doesn't work. When you design a study, you can, by the way you design a study, determine the outcome. You can do a study that shows, for example, that fish oil doesn't lower your risk of heart disease. And all you have to do is underdose the fish oil. If you give too low a dose, I could design a study that would prove that penicillin doesn't kill streptococcus. All I would have to do is underdose the penicillin and the streptococcus would be fine. We could disprove, if you set the study up so that you are not going to have a positive effect by design, you can disprove it. It gets published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It's really interesting. I'm going to throw in a little bias here. There's a little bias in publications. When there's a study that shows that pharmaceutical X doesn't work, it never gets published in a major medical journal. It rarely gets published at all. But if there's a study that shows that some herb or some natural therapy has negative results, that always gets major headline front page news results. And a lot of times it doesn't work. If you go and read the method section, they're underdosing. They're using less than the recommended dose. And yeah, well, I'm not surprised it didn't work when you didn't do it right. But it always gets front page news. There's definitely a selection bias in the literature.
Oh, absolutely. Could I mention just one very quick thing?
Sure.
A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about testing older drivers. And
yes.
A friend of mine who heard the program suggested that one might be able to use simulators that are used for training school children in driving to test older drivers.
Yes. I think as an economic consideration, that might be worthwhile. One does wonder about how well the experience of the simulator truly simulates it. I mean, I don't know. In my driver's training class, you basically sat at a desk with a fake steering wheel and they ran a film in front of you, and it wasn't really very much like actually driving.
Being on the road.
But
anyway,
honest to God, most of the seniors that I'm worried about that I see in the office that I really feel probably should be tested, I doubt you'd even get out of the parking lot with them, because I think that what would happen is that they would do what I'm worried that they'll do, which is freeze in the headlights, deer in the headlights. So the minute that there's an inspector in the car, which is going to make you a little bit nervous, but you know what? You need to be able to handle being a little bit nervous if you're going to drive.
Absolutely.
And so if it makes you so nervous that you forget how to put the key in the ignition, you failed. Sorry, that's it. That you know, you don't get a driver's license, because you have to be able to deal with a near-miss accident, and then you have to be able to pull it back together and stay on the freeway. I remember years and years ago, I was involved in one of these major pileups up on the Yolo Parkway in Sacramento. They get this horrible fog. She was in her 80s, according to the newspaper. You know, she couldn't see where she was going. She's on a two-lane highway going through the fog. There's no place to pull over, but she can't see where she's going, so she stops.
Oh,
really bad idea.
Really bad idea.
Really, really bad idea. That sort of thing is what we are kind of testing people for. Do they have enough reserve mentally to be able to pull together after an unexpected event? Because driving is full of random, unexpected events.
Isn't it, though?
Yes.
Okay, well, keep on with it. I'm glad you took it up. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm waiting to have my tires slashed for having taken it up, but oh well, no good deed goes unpunished. Let's talk to Bruce in Elkhorn. Hello, Bruce. Hi.
A couple of quick comments to make, and one was just on the scopolamine, and that's available in tablet form.
Yes.
So you can actually moderate the dosage, because the problem with the patch is that it's one dose fits all. So if you're a 100-pound woman or a 300-pound man, you're getting the same dosage.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and that is a problem.
An overdosage, whereas with a pill, just because my wife suffers from seasickness, has been able to moderate the dosage to minimize the side effects and still get the benefits.
Does your wife have occasion to use the patch frequently?
Never uses the patch because we've got
all right,
pills.
To use your pills.
Two puts her to sleep. One doesn't do enough, so she takes 1.5, and that's the right dosage for...
How often does she need it?
Whenever she goes out on a boat.
How often is that? That's what I'm trying to get.
Go diving. So she's very susceptible, as opposed to there are some people that are somewhat susceptible, but in her case, she's very susceptible.
I would suggest also considering investing in one of the little electronic bracelets that fit on your wrist and send a little electrical impulse into pericardium or master of the heart 6, which is the acupuncture point for nausea.
I've been a sailor for years, and some people, they benefit, a lot of people, that most people don't. And that's why I was going more the scopolamine
route. Yeah, well, the drug is always going to be stronger. Thank you. Thanks
the comment
for the
I just made
comment.
Was that there, and I don't know, you may be aware of it as well, but there was a 2009 European Congress on Obesity in Amsterdam last week.
Mm-hmm.
And they presented a paper there that was from an Australian researcher, but they looked at U.S. FDA data and over the last 30 years, and they basically came to the conclusion that obesity in the United States was due entirely to overeating, not to lack of physical activity.
Yes, I did see that. What do you think? Do you agree?
I think you get, obviously, cardiovascular benefits in terms of heart disease and things from exercise that are independent of whether you want to lose weight for, you know, cosmetic or other reasons. So I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I think that there, when I stop and try to remember the changes that have occurred, one of the big changes since, say, 1980, which is when the numbers started going upward, is that they put high fructose corn syrup in Coke and sodas, and they made the sodas bigger. And then they made the sodas bigger again in the 1990s. And so a soda now has like 10 teaspoons of sugar in it, a single soda. And as I said, the sodas have gotten larger. And we tend to think in terms of, you know, one bottle of soda a day. But actually, compared to the size in 1970, you're drinking twice as much.
Well, there was a study that showed restaurant servings were up 400% compared to what a restaurant serving, say, if you got a steak dinner in 1955. Versus in 1995, you're getting four times as much. And
mm-hmm.
So people are selling you on a 32-ounce steak or 16, and so our portions have gone way up. Well.
And there is obviously the psychological tendency to eat what's on your plate.
Yes.
So what's the answer, do you think?
I think it's realizing that you need to just cut back, that there's substitute for smaller plates, smaller portions.
Well, maybe what we need is a social convention that it's okay to go to a restaurant as a couple and order one plate, order one serving and divide it into two plates. And
well, a trick we got from a friend of my wife's is actually she asks for a take-home container at the start of the meal and puts half in it.
Now, that's a good idea. Get it out of the way so that you don't absentmindedly eat it.
Take it home and then it's another dinner later in the week.
That's a very good strategy. I think we all need to fight fire with fire here. It's a behavioral problem. You fight it with behavioral tactics. And maybe I'll think about doing a show on that.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Carolyn in Carmel. Hello, Carolyn. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a quick question about my recent thyroid test levels. My doctor had prescribed hormones that I do not want to take, but I thought I'd give you the levels and see what you think.
Okay.
My TSH level was 1366.
Mm-hmm.
T4 was 0.09 and T3, 291.
All right, so what you've got there is you've got a low normal range T4. I mean, probably normal range. I don't have them exactly memorized, but those are ballpark low normals on your T4 and T3. And so your doctor is following the standard conventional wisdom. As long as those numbers are in the normal range, you don't treat the TSH. You treat a symptomatic patient, and so that's the question I have for you. Are you symptomatic? Do you have weight gain, dry mouth, hair loss, skin texture changes, hypersomnia, low energy?
No. Well, I have weight gain. Last couple of years, I have gained weight, dry skin. My hair seems to be okay.
What's your cholesterol?
Cholesterol was, let me see, that was...
Normal?
It was normal.
It was normal is fine, because that's one of the other hidden findings. What I would suggest you do is get tested for thyroid peroxidase.
Thyroid peroxidase.
That's an antibody.
Oh, okay.
Against the thyroid. And if you are thyroid peroxidase negative and asymptomatic, then I think you could go either way. You could sit tight with this and just, if you're fine, you're fine. Monitor it, because if it continues to go up, then probably the T4 and T3 are going to drop. But I think what we're seeing here is we're seeing you early in the course of an autoimmune attack on your thyroid, or we're seeing you shortly after a viral illness which messed up your thyroid.
Okay, I didn't have that.
And that you will recover fully. The short version of this is that you get a viral infection of the thyroid gland. It stops making thyroid for a while. The TSH goes up. The TSH tends to stay up for a while. Meanwhile, the thyroid recovers. But because the feedback loop is a slow to adjust itself, you've still got the high feedback loop signal. Another TSH in 6 weeks, still elevated, would basically disprove that theory or that hypothesis.
Okay. Is there anything naturally that I can take? Some herbs or anything harmful?
What's your goal?
Goal of what?
Well, I mean, you said, is there any herbs I can take? You shouldn't take herbs unless you have a reason. Do you think you need them?
Oh, I thought if it would help get this level down.
Well, are we going to consider that there's something wrong with you?
Well, it seems high.
Okay. I'm just saying, because that's debatable based on what I just said. You might just want to sit tight and see if there actually is something wrong with you.
Oh, okay.
But should you want to treat this situation naturally, iodine and selenium are both things that help the thyroid gland, particularly iodine.
Okay.
Iodine is tricky to give. You don't want to just kind of go out and buy a bunch of kelp tablets. You need to research it a little bit. We don't have time for that today.
Okay.
Where are you living?
Carmel.
Okay. So you could come up and see me, or you can arrange a phone consult through my website.
Oh, okay.
And I can kind of walk you through it. But I won't do that on the air because that would represent practicing medicine.
Right.
And I need to see those numbers.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your help. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's take a moment since we've got one. I wanted to comment on the $2 trillion offer to hold down health costs from the private sector. Is this ever a transparent move or what? I mean, I'm glad that we don't have Mildred and Harry and we've got an alternative. We've actually got a coalition going. But basically what the health plan said was we will decrease the rate of increase in our rates by 1.5%. So it won't be 7% a year. It'll be 5.5% a year. And we just want to be your friends, and we really, really, really don't want the government to have a health plan that the middle class can buy into, because that's going to affect our profit margin. So we'll bargain here. I mean, this is just such obvious poker. It's crazy. And meanwhile, in the back of the back rooms, the Associated Press got a document leaked by the Democratic leaders, probably on purpose. The Democrats have still not agreed, the Senate Finance Committee has still not agreed whether their bill should include the choice of a government insurance health plan for middle income families. Anyone out there within the reach of my voice, get on your cell phone, get on the internet, get on Twitter. I don't know what you use, but get on it and please, please tell your senator that we need a government-sponsored option to the health plans. It's the only thing that is going to keep this from turning into the TARP. It's going to turn it into government aid to the health plans unless there's a competitor out there who keeps them honest. So please, 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 this is the moment to weigh in on this one. Well, we've got time for one quick call, and it's John in Freedom. John, you've got about a minute and a half to tell us about the alternative for nausea.
I don't know much about it. I wanted to ask you, is anandamide. It's supposed to be the endogenous chemical in our body.
Right.
That's similar to THC.
Right. It's basically a cannabinoid neurotransmitter. So you know how endorphin, it's like people respond to opiates. There must be a natural opiate. We call it endorphin. This is the natural cannabinoid. So it probably is great. And you know the wonderful thing about this? You can patent it and charge a lot of money, as opposed to marijuana, which you can actually grow in your backyard, in California at least, with a doctor's certificate certifying that you need it, which nobody can patent or tax. You get a sense that I have an opinion?
Yes.
I don't think we need this. I think it's nice that now somebody will go and try to make a drug so that they can patent it, and I think that that's ridiculous. We've already got a natural compound that works perfectly well.
But what about the influence? I mean, I enjoy the influence, but I mean, if I'm going boating or diving, I wouldn't necessarily want the influence of the euphoria.
Yes, but there's no evidence that they're going to be able to produce a drug that isn't euphoric.
And then one last question would be, there's an under-the-tongue spray called Sativex, and I don't know how to get it in America. I got MS, and I've been trying to see if I can get it, but I'm tired. I mean, smoking is not good for you, so.
Okay, well, can't help you on how to get something that's not legal in this country. The internet is your good resource there. But watch out for sourcing, because I had somebody buy Ribavivant, which is that weight loss drug that's based on marijuana. They thought they were buying it from England, and they spent like a couple $100 to buy it. And what it came, it had actually come from like India. And I looked at the label and I was like, I don't really think this is what you think it is, and I wouldn't advise taking it. So you got counterfeiting stuff when you go on the web.
I guess I couldn't order the Sativex legally then, right? I mean, it's not something that you are allowed to order. I guess you wouldn't know offhand.
Not only wouldn't I know, I wouldn't tell you if I did. We're on the radio, man. Okay.
I appreciate that.
Okay. They know where I live. All right. Bye-bye. Okay. Well, on that pleasant note, we've come to the end of another hour of Ask Dr. Don. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.